Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part two of our talk about beans. You know, I'm thinking this one's going to be even it's like a two-bean salad if the last episode was a one-bean salad. We got a lot of great stuff to get to today.
Well, this is one I think that it especially will I don't know if it'll make everyone think about beans in a new way, but it might. It might just, because I feel like, especially in that first episode, we were kind of approaching, or I was certainly approaching it like, you know, beans are very interesting, but they're also kind of mundane. And the mundane nature of beans seems to run deep.
You have bean doubt.
To a certain extent. But in the space between recording the last episode and recording this one, I found a number of new angles and then leapfrogged off a couple of angles you explored. And I think it really paints a picture of beans as a far weirder part of our world and a part of our culture and myth making, even if a lot of that weirdness has largely been sort of bled out of sort of the like popular modern understanding of the food.
Yeah, I think that's right. So if you out there still have bean doubts, allow us to try to evaporate them with some deft parching through today's episode. So I wanted to start off today by talking about philosophers and beans and a particular bean field slaughter from Greek history/legend. So there are actually a surprising number of stories about Greek philosophers and beans. There was one that I came across. In the last episode, I mentioned this book that I had been quoting by Ken Albala called Beans, A History from Bloomsbury Publishing in 2017. And I'm going to refer back to that book a lot in this episode, too. But there was one thing I came across in that was talking about the Cynic philosopher Diogenes, who the one fact you may remember about him, if nothing else, is that he famously lived in a jar in Athens instead of in a house.
In a jar, like on a shelf.
No, not on a shelf. I think it was like out in a public square or something. Mm-hmm. It was like a turned over jar. And this is consistent with the idea of the Cynic school of philosophy, which is not about cynicism in the modern English use of the word, which means a sort of, I don't know, a pessimistic suspicion of others. The Cynic school of philosophy meant rejecting unnatural social norms and conventions and sort of being true to yourself or true to your nature. So Diogenes was famous for violating taboos and rejecting the conventional norms of Greek culture in his day. So I think he was known for being dirty, of course, living in a big ceramic jar, for hanging out with dogs, I think for being nude and doing inappropriate things in public. Like, if I remember correctly, there's a story that he decided to defecate while in the middle of watching a play. But apparently another way that he showed contempt for society's norms and the normal sort of like a food valorization scale is that he made a point of eating a type of bean known as lupins. This is a bean that was considered in many cases only fit for feeding to animals or for the extremely poor and starving. Now, of course, this is not true. Lupins are a perfectly good food if prepared in the right way, and they're part of many food traditions around the world. But that, like we talked about in the last episode, there are often negative cultural and especially class associations with certain types of beans. And you can say lupins are they're a difficult bean. They're a bean you really got to get to know because they've got these toxic alkaloids in them that you have to get out of them by soaking the beans for a long time. And supposedly you got to do all this other stuff to make them appetizing. But so I think by eating them, Diogenes was sort of doing the equivalent of saying, like, you know, look at me, I'll eat dog food. I don't give a crap. But the Greek philosopher bean connection I really want to talk about is between beans and Pythagoras. So the ancient Greek philosopher and religious leader Pythagoras lived from about 570 to 490 BCE, and though he was extremely influential, it is actually hard to know all that much with certainty about the life of Pythagoras because none of his writing survives, so we have nothing from his own hand. Mm-hmm. And the earliest accounts of his life and teachings come from hundreds of years after he lived, and they often differ substantially from one another. So when exploring basically any factual claim about Pythagoras and his teachings, there's going to be disagreement within our sources and in the analysis of modern scholars. So unfortunately, there's not a lot you can say about him with certainty. But with that in mind, there's a lot of stuff you can say about him that can be understood as according to some sources.
Right. We have echoes of Pythagoras as opposed to just Pythagoras like itself in a pure recorded form.
Right. But in these echoes from Pythagoras, some really interesting facts emerge. So a bit of basic background. Pythagoras was born on the Greek island of Samos, again, sometime around the year 570 BCE. He was said to have traveled extensively around the ancient world in his youth, and he eventually founded a sort of religious commune in Croton, a place in the south of Italy. Pythagoras taught some kind of mystical beliefs that unified aspects of metaphysics about the soul and the universe with mathematics and numbers, which seemed to occupy some kind of sacred position in his worldview, as well as music, which tied in with the mathematical aspects, and also teachings about nutrition and politics. So, like in the realm of politics, it seems that the Pythagoreans disdained tyranny and they really disdained democracy. They favored a kind of oligarchy where the body politic would be ruled by supposedly the best of men, you know, rulers appointed for their virtues. Mm.
That always works out.
Yeah. And in terms of nutrition, again, there's some disagreement, but the Pythagoreans were widely understood to be vegetarians, eating bread, honey, and vegetables. More on that in a bit. Now, as with his life and his teachings, there are a bunch of conflicting accounts of the death of Pythagoras, but I wanted to start with one of these stories about his murder at the hands of a mob. And, it's hard to keep all these straight, but I think in this account, or at least in some of these accounts, he's attacked by a mob that favors democracy. So the people have spoken, and it is time for Pythagoras to be slaughtered. So this account comes from the writing of Diogenes Laertius, who is probably writing sometime around the 3rd century CE. So understand that that's like hundreds of years, well, like 700 or 800 years after Pythagoras lived. It's a long time later. Oh, and this is translated by C.D. Yonge. Diogenes writes the following. Pythagoras died in this manner. When he was sitting with some of his companions in Milo's house, some one of those whom he did not think worthy of admission into it was excited by envy to set fire to it. But some say that the people of Crotonid themselves did this, being afraid lest he might aspire to tyranny, and that Pythagoras was caught as he was trying to escape, and coming to a place full of beans, he stopped there, saying that it was better to be caught than to trample on the beans, and better to be slain than to speak, and so he was murdered by those who were pursuing him. And in this way also most of his companions were slain, being in number about 40, but that a very few did escape." So what? When I first read this, I was like the pigeon in Moonraker that does a double take. I did the what? So according to this story, Pythagoras and his followers were running away from a violent mob, and they came to a bean field, and they decided it was better to stop running and get chopped to pieces by the crowd than to step on the beans.
This is the first time I'll mention this, but I'll probably mention it again. So in the previous episode, I made a statement about how you know, beans are less interesting compared to corn, that corn is spookier, that it's children of the corn, not children of the bean, that and likewise, you know, you would maybe be afraid of he who lurks behind the rose in the cornfield, but not in the bean field. Like, there's something about a cornfield that can be kind of creepy, especially in Stephen King stories. But when we look back through in this account, but also in other accounts that we'll look at later on, we really get the feeling that certainly there were no cornfields in Italy at this time. Like bean fields were that place. So if you can imagine a Stephen King story where a fringe religious leader on the run refuses to go into the corn, would rather face death by mob than go into the corn. Like, that makes sense in a Stephen King story. So just sort of imagine that it's beans instead of corn in the Stephen King universe. And I feel like we get an appropriate idea of how Pythagoras and his followers are believed to have felt at this point.
Right, at least according to this story. But yeah,
right.
You're exactly right. I love it. And there are other versions of the story, by the way, particularly told by one author named Iamblichus, who say that it was not Pythagoras himself who died because he wouldn't cross a bean field, but that it was a cadre of his disciples who were chased to the edge of the field and then accepted this gruesome death rather than cross it. And in Iamblichus's version in particular, there's this detail that the last member of Pythagoras's followers who were slain was a pregnant woman named Timica, who bit off her own tongue rather than reveal the secret of why the beans were prohibited. That's more walking behind the rose, I think.
Yeah, that's some straight up Stephen King juice right there.
Now, as I mentioned, there are other accounts of the death of Pythagoras, but what we know is that either this account is in some way based on the truth, or if not, it was at least considered plausible enough to believe, given what people knew about Pythagoras in the ancient world. And it seems that one of the things widely known about him was that he really disdained beans. I've come across some really good illustrations of him, you know, just saying like no to beans. Like, he's standing next to a bunch of beans and he's like, uh-uh.
Yeah, both hands up.
Yeah.
Looking away.
Get away. So why on earth would anybody believe that this ancient Greek religious leader would rather die a painful, bloody death than trespass the bean field? Well, there are a ton of possible answers, and in a way, I think they're all fascinating. But here's one of the main ones that I wanted to talk about, and we'll go through a number here as explored by Albala in his book. But one of the main things comes down to a teaching that is consistently associated with Pythagoras in the earliest writings about his life, which is that he taught the metaphysical doctrine known as metempsychosis, which is usually translated into English as the transmigration of souls. This is actually very similar to other ideas of reincarnation that you might have encountered before. So according to the doctrine of the transmigration of souls, the Pythagoreans believed that there was an immaterial and immortal soul that was separate from the body. This soul would survive the death of the body, and after the death of the body, the soul would be installed in a new body, possibly the body of another human or another animal. And this probably connects to one of the other Pythagorean teachings that I mentioned before, which is that it's widely understood that the Pythagoreans preached against the eating of meat. He and his followers were said to be vegetarians. And if he was both a vegetarian and a believer that, human souls and animal souls would transmigrate back and forth into human and animal bodies, you can kind of see how these beliefs would fit together. Like if you were to eat a chicken or a cow, you might literally be cannibalizing a dead relative. Now, if this is truly what Pythagoras taught, it is not known for sure where he got this idea, though it's been speculated that he could have acquired it from Indian thought during his travels. It is said that he traveled all over the ancient world. But where this idea comes from, we just don't know.
Yeah, it obviously it sounds like in many ways, like a less robust version of reincarnation as you encounter it in Buddhism and Hinduism. So it would be interesting if this was an idea that he picked up in his travels.
There are some ancient authors, like I recall reading somewhere that I think it might have been Herodotus who said that Pythagoras got this idea from the Egyptians, but I don't think there's any indication that Egyptian religion ever featured reincarnation in this way. So that seems to be probably a mistake on Herodotus' part. Now, a slight variation on the reasoning here is just that vegetarianism was considered consistent with a non-violent way of life preached by the Pythagoreans. But so this makes sense, right? You don't know the exact reason, but it would seem to all sort of fit together if he believed in the transmigration of souls and also preached vegetarianism that, you know, don't eat animals because they might have souls that you would, you know, wouldn't want to be eating in them. But then there's this other strange dietary prohibition of the Pythagorean cult, which is that Pythagoras allegedly forbade his followers to eat beans.
Yeah, which again, modern vegetarians and vegans, you know that you need the beans.
So yeah, exactly.
It seems counterintuitive in several ways.
Yes, this is a problem, right? Now, at the time within Greek culture, these would have been overwhelmingly, this would have been referring to fava beans, mm-hmm. like the Phaseolus genus that gives rise to many of the common beans we eat today. That is a genus that comes from the Americas and had not crossed the Atlantic yet. So probably what they're talking about here are fava beans, though I guess there could have been lentils and stuff too, but it seems they were referring to fava beans. And fava beans were a common source of food for people and for grazing animals, like for cattle, in the Mediterranean at the time. Of course, beans are an especially important food if you're a vegetarian. So why would Pythagoras have forbidden not only eating them, but even treading upon them, even going into a field where they're being grown? Well, here I'm going to quote from Albala's book. Quote, "The simplest and perhaps most plausible explanation is that beans are part of the whole cycle of reincarnation, and they house human souls. To eat a bean is thus a form of murder." This was Varro's explanation. An Orphic fragment puts it like this: eating beans and gnawing on the heads of one's parents are one and the same.
Wow.
I think that's a sufficiently vivid image, right? Like, you want to eat beans? How would you feel about chewing on your dad's head? It's very Dantean, actually. It makes me think of Count Ugolino and Archbishop Ruggieri. The idea here would be that beans contain souls, potentially human souls. Now I want to get into more explanation on that mode of thinking in a bit, but first I also just wanted to mention some alternative explanations offered by other writers over the centuries, which Albala sort of catalogs and discusses. Now, there are some explanations for the bean prohibition that would be based in politics. So I think these would be more sort of metaphorical interpretations of the idea that Pythagoras would have bean scorn. One idea here is that beans were a symbol of democracy, the democracy that Pythagoras hated, because beans were used to cast votes, right? You might have a jar where if you want to vote yay, you put in a black bean, and if you want to vote nay, you put in a white bean, or maybe you put in different jars, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. It can be a way to tally anonymous votes. Of course, in a proper oligarchy, nobody would need to vote with beans, right?
That's right. The best rule, and then you just keep your beans at home or in the field.
Or you just keep them away. But also the idea here is that there could be a political implication, which is just that beans are the food of the working class, whereas meat was preferred by the rich elites. And probably in Pythagoras's view, the better people, the people who deserve to rule because of their virtues, would have been associated with meat. Well, you know, whereas the people who don't know how to rule a city, they would be the people eating beans.
I guess one way, one thing we have to sort of think about with this idea of this being the part of the Pythagorean belief system is to realize too that like, it doesn't mean they were necessarily going out trying to liberate the bean fields or necessarily trying to change the way that other groups consumed food. They could have been very like closed off from them and saying, this is how we live. This is, and then we are better for it. I think that's kind of a distinction. I think in general, we have to keep in mind when thinking about different religious groups in the contemporary world for sure, but also just historically that not every religious group is going to be about spreading their belief system to all around them.
Right. And not all like religious dietary restrictions are meant to be a universal rule.
Right.
For example, I think there are a lot of religious scholars of, say, like Judaism and Islam that would say like prohibitions on pork and other types mm-hmm. of food that are prohibited within that religion are not meant to be universal prohibitions, but they're prohibitions for the faithful.
Right.
But then again, I'm not sure if we that's a possibility always when you're considering dietary restrictions that are advocated by religious groups. But I do recall coming across at least one legend, though I don't recall the source of this, where Pythagoras was said to have tried to convince a cow not to eat fava beans. So if you're preaching to cows, it probably means you want all humans to obey as well.
Right. But then again, that also sounds like a perfect parody of someone whose belief system you don't agree with or don't completely understand. You're like, oh, I bet Pythagoras is out there. What's he going to do? Is he going to tell the cows not to eat beans?
Yeah. That could very well be the context there.
Yeah.
Okay, so there are other possible explanations. One is more nutritional and psychological. You know, pretty straightforward. Beans give you gas, and gas prevents you from having a clear head. And a lot of ancient philosophers were really concerned about, like, cutting things out that would cause problems in the body that would interfere with you having clear thinking. You got to have a clear head to live a good life, and so you can't be going around farting.
You know, this is interesting because I was thinking about this, like in terms of how we think about flatulence and flatus, it's easy to have a very like one-to-one vision of that. You know, the idea of like, well, farting is distracting and you don't want to do it. That's going to mess with your mental outlook. Or, you know, we'll get into some of these ideas later where it's like, well, a fart is a ghost. You don't want ghosts coming out of your butt, you know, that kind of thing. But there's an idea that I ran across in a book that I was really enjoying reading through, a 1999 book called Plants of Life, Plants of Death by Frederick J. Simmons, and which deals not only with beans, but various other plants and traditions in a number of different cultures in the East and in the West and in Africa, etc., about how there are these different ideas of life and death wrapped up in them. And in getting into the idea of beans and flatulence and in discussing Pythagorean bean bans, he discusses several of the possibilities, but one that I hadn't really thought about was the connection between flatulence and bad dreams. Mm. And he credits Friedericus Baum in this idea, but I've also read that Diogenes touched on this in considering Pythagorean ideas. Quote, "One should abstain from fava beans since they are full of wind and take part in the soul. And if one abstains from them, one's stomach will be less noisy and, this is key, one's dreams will be less oppressive and calmer." Now, that quote attributed to Diogenes was brought up in an LA Times article on beans from 1996 by Russ Parsons. But I thought that was interesting and perhaps more telling. Yeah, if your sleep is troubled, if your dreams are troubled because you're going to bed gassy with beans, then that could very well darken your outlook on life or mess with your head, especially in an age where you have, you know, maybe more supernatural ideas concerning dreams and the interpretation of dreams.
Yeah, that's really interesting. But I mean, another way to think about it, though, I guess, is like it's kind of like the coach of the chess team is also going to be like telling all of their players, like, don't eat cookies right before, don't eat pickles when you're going to bed or something.
Oh, yeah.
They're trying to keep their people in like ship shape.
Yeah. Like reading through some of the other stuff in Simone's book, you get into a lot of there are prohibitions against foods because their connection to dreams, but also prohibitions against foods that could be consumed in a dream. Like, it's not that you shouldn't eat basil mm-hmm. before you go to bed, but if offered basil within the dream, you should abstain. Now, I was looking for more.
That's
on
just
the
a promise I can't keep.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, once you're in the dream, I mean, not to say nothing of the dream within a dream. But I was looking around for a little bit more about this, and I found an echo of this sentiment in Iranian traditional medicine. In the 2014 paper, Insomnia in Iranian Traditional Medicine by Faisabadi et al., here's the quote. Upward movement of rancid vapors towards the brain due to eating flatulent and vaporous foods. Beans, lentil, leek, and fenugreek cause upward movement of vapor towards the head, heavy-headed feeling, headache, depraved illusion, nightmares, and consequently awaking at night and fearing during sleep.
Wow.
So yeah, I think after reading that, I'm even more convinced. Yeah, if you're you know, gassy and full of nightmares and flatus is waking you up in the night, I could see where that could lead into some ideas that, yes, these are some foods that should be avoided, certainly before you go to bed, but maybe in general if the dreams are bad enough.
Well, that makes me want to respond to these folk beliefs with some actual science on farting and beans. So what if we take a brief little detour here on the science of legumes and flatulence?
Yeah, let's get down to it. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver. And this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courtney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
Okay, so the question is, do beans cause flatulence? That seems to be a widely believed association. And if so, why do they cause flatulence? Well, the answer seems to be yes, they do, but maybe not as much as you might think, and that there are very good, well-known reasons why they cause flatulence. So the gas produced during the digestion of beans is actually not produced by the cells of your body themselves, but by your gut microbiota. The bacteria, particularly in your large intestine, that break down molecules that your own metabolism sort of gives up on. Dried beans, even after cooking, usually contain compounds known as oligosaccharides. And I found an article in the Journal of Nutrition explaining this. This was by, in fact, I wonder if we have cited this article before. It may have come up in our Fartonomicon episode several years back. But this is by Donna M. Winham and Andrea M. Hutchins from the Nutrition Journal, called Perceptions of Flatulence from Bean Consumption Among Adults in 3 Feeding Studies. This was published in 2011. And so I just wanted to look at the relevant paragraph where they break down the metabolic pathway that causes flatulence as a result of eating dried beans. So, quote, most legumes contain relatively high amounts of both dietary fiber and resistant starches. These would be the oligosaccharides I just mentioned. The soluble oligosaccharides found in legumes are not digestible by human intestinal enzymes alone. Instead, oligosaccharides such as raffinose and stachyose are broken down by bacterial fermentation in the intestines. Although some rectal gas is due to the ingestion of air, the majority of flatulence is produced from bacterial fermentation. The byproducts of this degradation are hydrogen, carbon dioxide, methane, and sometimes sulfur, depending on the bacteria. Normal intestinal processes move these gases out of the body in the form of flatus. So the primary cause of beans leading to farts is the action of the bacteria in the gut, I think specifically the large intestine, fermenting these starches that the body can't break down on its own, these oligosaccharides. And the authors also point out that while there is evidence that eating beans can increase flatulence on average, there is a lot of individual variation. So they're not going to increase flatulence or increase it at the same rate for everybody. To quote from the results of their feeding studies measuring flatulence, quote, less than 50% reported increased flatulence from eating pinto or baked beans during the first week of each trial. Only 19% had a flatulence increase with black-eyed peas. A small percentage, 3 to 11%, reported increased flatulence across the 3 studies even on control diets without flatulence-producing components. And so, yes, it does appear that on average beans do increase flatulence, but they say that people's concerns about excess farting from eating beans may be exaggerated compared to how much difference they actually make. Now, coming back to a note that's explored in Albala's book on this, mentioning that these starches that can't be broken down by the body itself but have to be fermented by the bacteria in the gut, these oligosaccharides, they have to be fermented in the large intestine specifically as a product of eating dried beans, not fresh beans. And this is interesting because you can see how that has it translates to the differing reputations of these vegetables. Like fresh green peas are beans. They are of the family Fabaceae. And I've never heard anybody link green peas to flatulence. They're eaten fresh. Fresh green beans are beans. They're beans still in their pods. They're actually the common bean, Phaseolus vulgaris, and yet they don't have this association either. So they don't seem to create these oligosaccharide problems. But there's a trade-off, of course, which is that by being served fresh, they have to be served more seasonally, or they have to be frozen. They don't offer the same advantages in terms of the simplicity and durability of their storage and shelf life version that you get from dried beans. But anyway, okay, scientific digression on flatulence done. Now I want to move back to Albula cataloging the reasons that Pythagoras might have disdained the eating of beans. So another explanation that has been given by writers over the years is, well, what if it's just because beans are too delicious? You know, this is basically a prohibition against gluttony. This is perhaps plausible, though it doesn't seem to fit with most of the other thinking of the time that looked on beans not as like a decadent luxury, but as like the exact opposite of that. Maybe this was just offered by some ancient writer who personally really loved beans.
Or perhaps, you know, the idea that it's something available in bulk enough that more people can be gluttonous about it. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, but yeah, you don't see that coming up a lot. Like the bean is not the symbol of gluttony. You don't think of, I don't think you do. You don't think of the bean. No. Like it is often attributed as sort of the food of the common man.
Okay, now we're going to get into sexual biomagical explanations, of which there are a number. So in this category, we get into some really weird territory. Under this explanation, and this was again put forward by a number of ancient writers who were commenting on abstention from beans. In this explanation, beans are to be avoided because in various ways they either resemble human genitals or they have something to do with sex, procreation, or regenerative power. And there are several ancient stories that compare fava beans in particular to female genitals, but there's another one that connects all the way back to the transmigration of souls explanation, and this goes from the connection of beans to testicles. Here I want to read from Albula again. Quote, Aristotle picks up this thread when he explains that beans are like testicles, but adds that they are like the gates of Hades in being the only plant that has no joints. That's some great Aristotle logic.
Yeah.
Now, what would that mean? Well, Albula continues, that is, bean stems are hollow and have no nodes and thus serve as a kind of elevator shaft from the underworld, the means of exchange for souls. Actually, they are specifically compared to a ladder, and this makes sense if one has ever seen fava bean pods protruding horizontally from a plant. They do resemble a ladder. This would explain the reluctance to run through a bean field and trample the stems, as well as the ban on picking the pods or rungs of the ladder. In short order, Aristotle also claimed that the beans were avoided because they are like the form of the universe, perhaps again a veiled reference to their regenerative power. Even odder is the idea that a nibbled bean leaf in the sun will smell like semen or the blood of a murdered person, which must smell different from ordinary blood. good editorializing from Albula there. In any case, all of these notions point to the idea that beans are some transitional form of human in the great transmigration of souls.
Wow.
Yeah, this one is putting flatulence in my brain. The vapors are floating up.
This is the kind of statement here that it can feel like genuine madness setting in, you know, where too many connections are made between unrelated things and then you end up seeing like the human soul in everything around you. It just sounds like just falling into the philosophic deep end and sinking to the bottom.
Well, we're going to sink even farther. These same types of associations, they keep going on. So Albula explores some linguistic connections between ancient words for beans in various languages, I think primarily in like Indo-European languages, and associations between that and words for swelling or rotundness, which could in some ways connect to ideas of swelling up with flatulence, but also to pregnancy, fertility, and the generation of life. And in the latter vein, many ancient authors seem to make an association that seems quite bizarre probably to most modern listeners, but an association between foods that make you fart and foods that make you sexually potent. Again, this, there's a basically a linguistic conceptual logic to it, especially in ancient Greek thought. And Albala explains it like this. So you've got pneuma, you know, this is where we get like the word pneumatic, P-N-E-U-M-A, meaning air or breath or soul. The Latin equivalent would be anima, as in like animated, like an animal is. So there's already this existing linguistic association between like the breath or the gas and what the soul is, and that this is the principle that animates a being and makes it alive. So like in much ancient Greek thought, when you die, your breath leaves you, you know, like the gas of your soul evaporates from your body. And also in the creation of life, there's a breathing of life into things as an exchange of gas, literally. Albala writes that the pneuma, quote, was the basic principle of life, and it is generated in the stomach in the form of gas, just as it is transferred in the act of reproduction. This also explains the bizarre association among authors like Pliny of flatulence with the libido. In other words, eating beans not only makes you fart, it helps you conceive. The bean actually contains the regenerative force. And so this can be applied in multiple different ways. Albala writes that you may want to eat beans to absorb the power of these souls if you're trying to like stimulate the farting and the libido part of your body. But like the Pythagoreans, you might want to do the opposite and avoid eating these beans because of the sort of like windy regenerative soul power that's contained within them. Very weird. Now, we've been exploring a lot of the explanations that lie behind this in terms of, I don't know, linguistic associations and religious thinking and stuff. But there are also some biological realities that Albala explores that could possibly have to do with beans and how they could have influenced the creation of this story about Pythagoras. These following explanations that I'm going to mention are not things that were explored by any ancient writers. These are modern explanations that have been offered. And the first is based on a heritable genetic condition that causes an enzyme deficiency. So most people can eat fava beans and breathe the pollen of fava bean flowers, and they're just fine. But there is a very rare inherited medical condition that causes a specific enzyme deficiency in the body, which can in turn cause catastrophic reactions to the ingestion of fava beans or fava bean pollen. And this condition is known as favism, caused by an underlying glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase deficiency, or G6PDD. People with G6PDD can have horrible, even deadly reactions to fava beans and their pollen. And if a person with this condition eats fresh raw fava beans, it can lead to a reaction called acute hemolytic anemia, or the sudden destruction of copious amounts of the body's red blood cells. Now, outwardly, this can result in symptoms like fatigue, difficulty breathing, fever, yellowing of the skin, dark urine, and in extreme cases, it can even be fatal. So a question some modern scholars have posed is, could Pythagoras have prohibited fava beans because he witnessed somebody having an acute reaction due to G6PDD? Interesting possibility, but it seems like one of the – I mean, there are a lot of explanations like this for – records of the ancient world that like fit together in interesting ways, but I don't feel like there's any particular reason to favor this hypothesis.
No, I mean it seems plausible. You know, either he witnessed this or he heard accounts of this happening. Hey, some people have been known to eat fava beans and grow, you know, extremely ill or even die. But yeah, if we don't have any specific cases for it, specific instances in the writing, then. Yeah, I don't know if we should put too much emphasis on it, yeah.
One thing is, it is interesting about the idea of avoiding not just eating the beans, but avoiding running into a bean field, like if the pollen could even trigger the reaction. I mean, yeah. That's kind of interesting.
You could definitely see it potentially playing into some of these ideas, especially if we get more and more into this realization that the bean fear and the bean holiness here is by no means just something that jumped out of Pythagoras's head.
Right.
This seems to have been a cultural idea, perhaps a widespread cultural idea, but we'll get more into that in a minute.
Now, another interesting scientific observation, again, this is not from ancient interpreters. This one might be original to Albala, but at least it's not ancient. This could complement the previous evidence that Pythagoras believed beings to contain souls. And the simple fact here is that sometimes it looks like bean plants bleed.
Mm.
Yeah, so there's a chain of biological causes at work here. Essentially, bean roots can become infected by a bacterium known as rhizobium. And these bacteria thrive in tiny little oxygen-starved chambers within the roots or nodes on the roots. And the bacteria exist in a mutualistic relationship with the bean plant. So the bacterium is, according to Albala, able to extract ammonium nitrate from the atmosphere, which it shares with the plant, which is good for the plant. And then the plant provides these little anaerobic nodes for the bacteria to live on and in. And they both create proteins that bind whatever free oxygen is available with the help of iron molecules. This might be familiar to people who know anything about animal biology or medical science. Albala writes, quote, "This protein is called leghemoglobin and functions much in the same way hemoglobin does in our blood, binding oxygen with iron for our bodies to use in cellular respiration. Moreover, when cut, the nodes are red, exactly like blood." So imagine being in the ancient world. You cut open a bean plant. There are parts of it that if you cut open might bleed or look like they're filled with blood. And these little nodes would look red like human blood for basically the same reason that human blood is red.
Now, I know a lot of you are probably thinking right now, you're thinking, well, I bet Pythagoras just hated beets then. And, you know, actually, according to Simmons, we do see aversion to beets in some cultures. He mentions prohibitions against, quote, "certain plants as food or temple offerings because their coats, flesh, or juice are similar to blood and meat in color." Mm-hmm. So he cites examples, members of the Banaya caste of the Punjab with meat prohibitions here extending to carrots, turnips, onions, and red lentils. Also the prohibition of beet roots and tomatoes at Brahmin meals in Gujarat, as well as Havak Brahmins in South India, among others. And he mentions how Fraser got into this a bit as well, the idea of like the similarity between things. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. He's not specifically talking about Pythagoras in this instance, but we do see this sort of thing in other cultures enough to realize it's kind of a universal phenomena of humans engaging with their food. Sometimes the food reminds you too much of a thing that is prohibited, and the prohibition will extend to those things, if not in an everyday way, then certainly within the realm of sacred ritual.
When it comes to beet specifically, I can imagine another cause for beet scorn, which would be possible horror at going to the bathroom after consuming beets, which can be, even though it doesn't hurt you, it just visually could be quite alarming.
Yes. Yeah. New parents, always warn your child the first time they have a lot of beets or blue cupcakes, either one. Now, I mentioned the idea that there, you know, this idea of bean weirdness and beans and death and reproduction and so forth, that it doesn't just emerge right out of Pythagoras's head, that it is perhaps more universal. That's an argument that Simmons makes in his book. He writes, quote, "Since parallels to Pythagorean beliefs about the fava bean are found in the bean beliefs involving various species of beans of widely scattered non-Indo-European peoples in Uganda, India, Japan, New Guinea, and the New World, we are likely dealing with basic human reactions to beans or legumes in general," which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, okay. So this would be the idea that since there are similar kinds of bean fascination and bean magical beliefs in all these different cultures that don't necessarily share, like, say, language or cooking traditions or anything like that. It might be something more just like about the raw biology of beans that causes people to have these sort of thoughts, like maybe the ways they look or things they do when you eat them.
Yes, and just thinking too hard and too long about how they relate to our own worldview and magical ideas. At this point, I want to run through just a few other bean ideas that, that Frederick J. Simmons brings up in Plants of Life, Plants of Death. These are all related to sort of what I loosely categorize as being death folk reliefs, sort of leaning into the Stephen King-esque world of beans in the bean field, being a place of death, a place of connection to the underworld, and potentially rebirth.
Okay, so we're going to walk behind the pods.
Yes. So he points out that there was a British folk belief that pregnant women should not eat beans because it could impact the child mentally. Additionally, bean blossoms have an evil reputation in northern and midland England in coal mining districts because it was long held that coal mining accidents were far more likely to occur when bean plants were blossoming.
Hmm.
He also writes that according to German folk belief, beans and peas were, quote, cult foods of demons, so it was best not to eat them on nights that were, quote, favorable for magical divination. Now, I have to admit, that all kind of sounds like a riddle to me. I'm not exactly sure would mean.
You, like, don't get down with the fava beans on Walpurgis Nacht.
Yeah, something like that, I would imagine. And certainly there's some more examples where we see beans connected to specific dates, specific traditional festivals, mm-hmm. Because also in Germany there were superstitions that eating peas on Twelfth Night, that's the 12th night after Christmas, that this would give you vermin infestations or leprosy, and that beans, peas, or lentils during this time could at least make you itch if you were to consume them. Now, there's another British folk belief that bean fields are inhabited by ghosts and spirits.
Mm.
And in 19th century Leicestershire, it was said that if you slept in a bean field all night, the awful dreams and resulting desires would just drive you insane. Like you would not survive a night in the bean field. Sleeping a night in the bean field would be like sleeping a night in a haunted house.
Whoa. But due to my bean love, I want to say it's going to be like that Simpsons episode where they have to spend a night in the haunted house but discover that the tap water tastes better than the stuff they have at home.
Now, I know what a lot of you are probably thinking. You're probably thinking, well, this is all well and good, but did beans ever march in battle, bringing forth an army of the undead to march alongside Ent-like walking trees in Welsh myth? Well, yes, they did, because Simmons points to the writings of the Welsh bard Taliesin, who described just such a scene, quoting the work, the elm trees, he quotes, quote, stood firm in the center of the battle. Heaven and earth trembled before the advance of the oak tree. The heroic holly and hawthorn defended themselves with their spikes. And then meanwhile, the beans took part in battle by, quote, bearing in its shade an army of phantoms.
Well, so beans and spirits again.
Yeah. This idea that like the bean field is where you find the ghosts that'll drive you either, you know, mad or fill you with maddening desire. And the idea that, yeah, if the trees were and all the plants were to rise up and march in an army, then the beans would surely lead an army of phantoms into battle. I love that.
Okay, I think we have a serious deficiency in the horror fiction and horror movies of today, a deficiency of bean-themed horror, right? This has got to be – somebody's got to pick up on this.
I feel like we have just largely abandoned our understanding of supernatural beans outside of like the one, you know, fairy tale about magic beans that grow gateways to the world of the giants. Now, speaking of fava beans, I was looking at a 2020 University of Copenhagen study looking into the possibility of fava beans taking over more from soybeans to meet the increasing popularity of plant-based meat alternatives, specifically in Denmark.
Hmm.
The argument here is that fava beans put less strain on the environment as a crop, and unlike soy, they can be grown locally in Denmark, as opposed to having to depend on soy, which is largely grown in the United States and in South America. And particularly in South America, that's where you get into some of the real environmental concerns about, you know, what kind of land is being transitioned into soy-growing land.
Yeah.
But the particular study here highlights the use of wet fractionation to concentrate fava bean protein and remove digestion-inhibiting substances in the beans. And the result is dry fractionated fava bean protein-rich flour. So I don't know where that will ultimately go, but it's an interesting bit of info there, and potentially insight into the future. Again, thinking about turning more and more to to artificial meats and bean-based diets, a return to the bean fields, mm-hmm. and perhaps a return to, you know, beans, depending on beans that grow more naturally within a given region.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. I'm Abby, a mother of two, and I had these battles myself. Endless excuses, delay tactics, and many tears and tantrums. But I've created a solution. The perfect kids podcast that makes bedtime a dream. It's called Koala Moon, and it's hosted by me, Abby. With over 300 episodes packed with original stories and sleep meditations, Koala Moon makes bedtimes easy and enjoyable. Episodes start out engaging and really rather magical, but as they progress, they gently slow to a calm and relaxing pace to have your little ones out like a light. Since launching in 2022, Koala Moon has helped with over 20 million nights sleep and received over 6,000 five-star reviews. Win back your evenings. Listen to Koala Moon now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, there's another great bean I wanted to talk about for a bit here, and that's the black-eyed pea, also known as the cow pea. And yes, it's called a pea, but it is a proper bean. It's in the family Fabaceae. And the modern species name of the cow pea is Vigna unguiculata, which was once known as Vigna sinensis because it was believed to have come from China, but this is now known to be incorrect. Modern botanists And archaeologists believe that these beans were first domesticated in Africa, probably originating in West Africa, though I've seen the possibility of Ethiopia as well. But Albala in his book notes that some of the archaeological evidence about their history, it comes from the Chad Basin, which seems to indicate that people who were originally making a living primarily through animal herding came into the area about 1800 BCE, and within about 600 years of occupying the Chad Basin, they began to convert to an agricultural civilization, with their staple crops consisting of pearl millet and black-eyed peas. So again, like we see in so many places in the world, a transition to a settled farming existence based on a sort of crop package of complementary grains and legumes. I think the examples we talked about in the other episode were, say, like you might have wheats or grasses like einkorn and lentils, or you could have maize and beans in the Americas. But black-eyed peas have been an important part of West African agriculture ever since, and they've eventually, of course, spread all over the world. They spread north to Europe, they spread east to Asia, and they're popular in all these different regions. And of course, they eventually became part of the food traditions of enslaved people taken from Africa to the Caribbean and to the southern U.S. So much like okra and rice, which were also imported from African culinary traditions, black-eyed peas ended up becoming foundational elements of southern American cooking in general.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen some, there's been some excellent cooking documentaries about this connection. And I have to say, if anyone out there, if you haven't had a bean sandwich connected to some of these African culinary traditions, or at least descended from them, I highly recommend it. Like, it's so good.
I love black-eyed peas, and I've never had a bean sandwich, so I got to look that up. Do you know a good place to get one in town?
I don't know that I've had one at a restaurant. We've just followed some recipes.
Okay.
But you can find some really good recipes online. In fact, there's some for black-eyed pea-based sandwiches, which can be a way to, because we have that kind of like loose New Year tradition of eat black-eyed peas, right? Because they're good luck, or it's part of a good luck suite of foods.
That's the health part of the package, right? You eat pork, black-eyed peas, and greens, and that's for what? Mm-hmm. Happiness, health, and wealth.
Yeah, yeah. And so black-eyed peas, if they're cooked certain ways, can be kind of a hard sell. But I tell you, if you make a really tasty sandwich with them, you're good to go.
Okay, well, I'm going to have to try the sandwich. But anyway, like other examples we've looked at, beans seem to occupy a sort of hub of religious significance in the West African context as well. And Albala mentions that, for example, in Yoruba religious practice, people would regularly offer meals, often based on black-eyed peas, to the godly beings or spirits of the Yoruba religion known as Orishas. And Albala quotes this interesting Yoruba proverb that goes, "You do not know what black-eyed peas are like for dinner." And I was like, whoa, I wonder what that means. But he explains that it refers to a person who is so stupid and negligent that he is totally unmindful of the consequences of his actions. So like, you're so dumb, you don't know what black-eyed peas are like for dinner. That's very good. But another interesting thing about black-eyed peas is that one of the cultivars that became especially popular in, I think, Eastern and Southeast Asia are the so-called yard-long beans. So these are a variety of cowpea. They are Vigna unguiculata, but they are the subspecies sesquipedalus. They are not actually a yard long, despite their name. I think they're usually about half that, but they are really long. I don't know if you've ever bought these and tried to cook with them. I remember kind of laughing as I was trying to like handle them one time at the farmer's market.
Yeah. I don't know if you included a picture. I don't know if we've actually tried to cook with peas this long, but, you'd have to like chop them in half, right? Or quarter them even.
I think sometimes you just shell them. Like you get the fresh peas out of them, but yeah, I'm not sure. I honestly do not remember what I did with them when I got them.
Bean enthusiasts, let us know. How do you handle these things?
I got another black-eyed pea fact that I think is very interesting, and this picks up on something we've mentioned a couple of times on the show before, It's one of those, you know, those sort of mind-opening moments that is triggered by a simple reimagination of a food item. In the past, we've talked about how avocados, you know, American audiences, mm-hmm. I think, primarily are going to think of avocados as a savory food, right? You have them in salty applications, or not necessarily, they don't have to be salty, but you wouldn't usually think of putting avocados in sweet foods, but that is by no means universal, and it is in no way based on objective things about the food itself. That's just a cultural convention. Avocados are used in sweet applications in all kinds of food traditions.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, avocado smoothies, for example, can be quite sweet and quite lovely.
But there's another food that's like this, black-eyed peas. Black-eyed peas are sometimes used in sweet rather than savory dishes. If you haven't had it, that can be kind of hard to imagine. But for example, I was finding a bunch of recipes for a Vietnamese dessert food that was like variations on the idea of sweet or coconut sticky rice with black-eyed peas.
Yeah, I mean that reminds me that you do encounter beans in a lot of East Asian desserts, mm-hmm. Where there'll be like a bean paste or a bean filling that'll be quite sweet.
Another one I haven't tried, but that's going on my list. So I got to have sweet sticky rice with black-eyed peas and a black-eyed pea sandwich.
Yeah, and get some red bean ice cream in there as well.
Mm.
It's good stuff. Now speaking of culinary traditions in East Asia, I thought we might take a little bit of time here to discuss the soybean, a vastly important bean and one of humanity's principal food crops. So in Chinese mythology, the soybean is one of the five grains, which are either sacred themselves or their history is considered sacred. I think it depends on the telling. So the exact listing of five grains varies, but I think every version, or at least every version I was coming across, does include soybeans, while some tellings will include the adzuki bean as one of the five grains. But the soybeans tend to make the list. And the five grains are often connected to the myths of Shinnong, the divine farmer, who we've talked about on the show before, the culture hero and mythological ruler of ancient China, often depicted in art as having bovine qualities to his appearance, including horns or horn-like nubs on his head.
Oh, yeah. We love Shinnong here. I think we talked about him in the mushroom foraging episode, didn't we? Because there's a legend that he sort of tested the mushrooms to see what was safe.
Right, because he is, in general, he being the father of agriculture, he's said to have sought out and sampled a vast multitude of plants, and you know, and that would include mushrooms in the ancient sense, in order to determine what was beneficial and what was not. And in doing so, it's also sometimes said that he sampled 70 poisons in one day. So again, it's the father of agriculture and to a large extent traditional medicine, but also he's just the personification of the gradual process of humanity figuring out what different plants do if they're consumed in different quantities. Now, as Heimowitz and Schertleff pointed out in 2005's Debunking Soybean Myths and Legends in the Historical and Popular Literature, there are a lot of myths about soybeans that get passed along, and they ultimately involve everyone from Shinnong to Benjamin Franklin. While it is sometimes said that the mythical Shinnong gave us the soybean as a domestic crop 5,000 years ago, the authors stress that the real time period is likely 11th century BCE or perhaps a bit earlier based on recorded history. So it's still really impressive.
Yeah. Now, do we know anything about how the soybean was domesticated, or does it seem like one of those things we have to infer, kind of like the examples we were talking about in part one, where it was probably like an accidental process of picking and then cultivating the ones, the pods that stayed closed the longest and the natural varieties?
I believe that's the case. I was reading Robert M. Stupar's Into the Wild from 2010 in PNAS, and the exact date they write is still a matter of dispute. And, quote, most estimates approximate the domestication occurred somewhere between 3,100 and 9,000 years ago. So, you know, a fair amount of leeway in any attempt to really pinpoint when this was domesticated.
Oh, yeah. This is actually something I came across with a number of beans referenced in Albala's book, which there are a number of cases where we really just don't know when they were first domesticated. Mm-hmm. It's just not, you know, big question mark.
Now, I want to get things back into the magical realm here because I ran across this wonderful tradition, this festival known as Setsubun. And it's a tradition in Japan involving beans. It's a spring festival, and it means changing of the seasons. And it has the same energy as a number of seasonal change traditions in Eastern cultures and just cultures in general, including the expulsion of evil spirits and bad luck and the invocation of good luck and good health. And this one in particular appears to have roots in Chinese Lunar New Year traditions that took on new form in Japanese culture. So one of the activities around this time, and you know, there's several different things. It's not just one thing you do, but one of the activities involves driving the oni out of one's house. So the oni, I think we've discussed them on the show before in one of our Halloween episodes. Oni were evil spirits or demons thought capable of causing illness and disease.
I think we may have even discussed some kind of traditions of driving the oni out of your house. This sounds very familiar.
Well, one way you can do it, especially at Setsubun, is by pelting them with roasted soybeans.
Ah.
These are also a traditional snack of the festivities, but they symbolize purity.
Oh, this makes me think of something that, is something that... So when I grew up, I always thought of beans being cooked in a wet application. You know, they're cooked in mm-hmm. water, boiled over time. Of course, you know, you usually need to do that to dry beans. Oh, because this is another thing we actually haven't talked about in this episode yet, but many, many dry beans can have high levels of toxins in them if you do not boil them before eating them. So you don't ever want to take a dry bean and then just soak it and eat it. That can give you food poisoning. You don't want to do that. You got to boil the beans or cook it with high heat somehow. But another common method in many food traditions around the world is roasting beans, roasting them dry in some way. And I think you could probably do this with fresher beans probably, but you can kind of pop some beans like you can make popcorn.
Yeah. And certainly if you're trying to drive oni out of the house, you don't want to be throwing like handfuls of canned beans or whole cans of beans.
That's going to be a mess.
Oni. Yeah, especially since a lot of the times you can look up pictures of this in video. It's pretty charming because apparently sometimes at schools you'll have a principal or a teacher put on the oni costume and the children will be in the hallways and then they will throw the beans at the oni to drive it out of the school.
Oh, that's great.
Now, I was reading a little bit more about this on the Japan Society website, and I want to read a quote from their webpage that gets into some more answers about why you would throw these beans at an oni. They write, quote, "To find an answer, we must go back in time and look at Chinese numerology, where many concepts come in fives to correspond to the five elements, wood, water, fire, metal, and earth. Soybeans were included in what were designated the five cereals, or the five most important crops." That's what we just talked about. Mm-hmm. They continue. "Soybeans, or da dao, literally the big bean, were considered particularly powerful because they were believed to contain the spirits of all the cereals combined. Mame, or bean, is a homophone for mame, and I'm sure I'm not saying mame correct in these cases, mm-hmm. but in both cases they're saying it means destroying evil. So soybeans were thought to be especially effective weapons against oni demons, somewhat like garlic is believed to be powerful against vampires in the West."
Wow. Okay. So the word bean is a homophone for another word that sounds similar but means destroying evil.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you see that connection come up time and time again when you're dealing with, you know, particularly with, I've seen this, you know, plenty of times in Chinese writings where, you know, something just doesn't translate. The various ghost stories in Tales from a Chinese Studio. Mm-hmm. Like in translation, they're all still really amusing. But a lot of times, if you were reading them in the original Mandarin, there would be homophones in place that would make everything more meaningful or perhaps more funny in some cases, that sort of thing.
Yeah, there are so many features of Chinese poetry that I've read about. It's just so difficult to capture effectively in translation. And I do love a lot of Chinese poetry in translation, but I mean, that's one thing. Another thing I've read about is just that like a lot of really good Chinese poetry has a quality of density that cannot really be communicated in English.
Yeah. This idea of using beans as a weapon against the demons, or some sort of protective amulet against demons, ultimately this can be found in plenty of other cultures as well. So I'd like to come back to Frederick J. Simmons' Plants of Light, Plants of Death, because he has a number of other examples in which the beans are serving as a weapon or a protection against evil spirits. He points out that British folk belief once held that beans were associated with witches, and you could protect yourself against a witch's evil spell by spitting a bean at her.
Rude.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't think you should spit beans at people that you think might be witches, but clearly it was once done. All right, here's another. He also writes that at the start of the 18th century on the Isle of Herries in Scotland, Molucca beans, especially white Molucca beans, were worn around the necks of children as a ward against the evil eye, and also just sort of witchcraft in general. And if evil magic came shooting in at the child, the bean would turn black.
Whoa.
Which also reminds me of some of the, we've talked about poison detection in various cultures. It sounds like trying to achieve the same thing, but with a bean.
Oh, like your little radiation detector badge, except it's for witchcraft.
Yeah. Now, there are other European beliefs of protective beans. Sicilian traditions held that beans had protective qualities for childbirth. So a woman in or approaching labor could eat 9 black beans, and that would serve as a protective, not really an amulet. It would be a protective act, I guess. Mm-hmm. There's also a tradition of stacking 9 black beans and placing them on a table near a newborn child to protect it from evil spirits.
Wait, how do you stack black beans?
I think it would be like a little pyramid of black beans. You kind of make a structure of the black beans.
Okay.
Now, in Morocco, an amulet of 7 black beans could be used to protect sheep and goats from smallpox. And 7 black beans could also be used by Moroccan scholars, or scribes rather, in order to become invisible. So, using black beans in some sort of sorcery.
Now, that's the kind of spell that I would imagine is probably more likely cataloged by somebody who attributes the use to others rather than somebody who did it themselves, because you could probably quite quickly find out if you were actually trying this that you cannot become invisible by using black beans.
Right. There are also traditions in Morocco of 5 black beans being used in protective amulets. So these might be, for instance, sewn into fabric. So you could have the 5 black beans in this piece of fabric that then you then wear as an amulet.
Hmm.
And he also makes mention in the book of European traditions concerning St. John's Eve. This is the eve of celebration before the feast day of St. John the Baptist. But the celebration itself existed before the coming of Christianity. It's tied, as Simmons explains, to summer solstice anxieties and the belief that this is a time when demons and evil spirits will rise up and must be driven back. And if this sounds a lot like Night on Bald Mountain from Disney's Fantasia, well, you are correct, because the original title of Mussorgsky's music was St. John's Night on the Bear Mountain.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was new to me as well. But at any rate, it's a time during which you have these various traditions involving fire, but also medicinal plants, such as St. John's wort. And unfortunately, it also entailed more than a little burning of black cats.
Ugh.
But given the fava beans' association with the underworld and spirits, it may have been connected as well. In Tuscany, St. John's fire was lighted in a field of beans to make them ripen faster, it said. And in Sicily, you ate your fava beans with a word of thanks to St. John. And there are other religions had traditions of 3 beans that were ritually consumed, representing wealth, competence, and poverty, depending on the state of the peeling.
Oh, yeah. Well, this ties into another thing. I guess we sort of got into this when I was mentioning Diogenes, the Cynic philosopher. But there is also a tradition of intentionally eating beans to signal asceticism, like the ascetic life, to say that I reject the pleasures of this world, and I'm going to be a person of the simple virtues of the spirit, meaning that, I'm not going to be eating butter and bacon every day. Instead, I'm going to be having beans. Which makes me think, of course, about the associations with John the Baptist, right? John the Baptist lived in the wilderness, and he, you know, he wore rough clothes and he ate honey and locusts, which might be the equivalent of a medieval European monk saying, okay, I'm just going to eat beans. I'm going to be a, you know, a person, I'm going to be a man of the wild and just commune with God.
Now, I have one more to mention here, and this one brings us back to German celebrations of Twelfth Night. And this was the idea that Germans and other Northern Europeans once would select a king of the bean, and sometimes a queen of the bean as well. And they would do this by baking a cake which contained a single bean. This would be like a single black bean, perhaps. And basically, it would be like everybody gets a piece of cake, and if yours has the bean in it, then congratulations, you are the bean king.
Now, was it good to be the bean king or bad to be the bean king? Because there are a lot of traditions where you get a special piece of cake, and that means you're kind of like scorned.
Yeah, well, this one doesn't seem particularly Wicker Man-y, if that's okay. What you're asking.
Yeah.
This is what he writes. Of particular interest to us is the report that the first act of a bean king, after he had been enthroned and congratulated, involved his being lifted three times to the ceiling of the house, where he drew white crosses of chalk on the beams and rafters to protect against evil spirits, devils, and witchcraft for the coming year. Also prominent in some places have been concerns about weather and crop fertility and yield, and the cake itself serving in divining good or bad things that might affect people in the ensuing year.
Okay.
So, I mean, I don't know what else it necessarily entailed, but that first major act of being king of the bean doesn't sound too bad.
No. It doesn't sound like they're about to throw him into the fire or anything.
No. All right. Well, hopefully we have introduced a new spooky supernatural world of bean fields to everyone out there and just made you think a little bit more about your beans. And we would love to hear from you. What are your favorite beans? Are you privy to any superstitions or customs or rituals involving beans that we didn't mention here? Because definitely write in and tell us about them. Also, do you own the company Rancho Gordo and want to send Joe and I free beans because we mentioned your company?
Oh, sponsor our show. Yeah.
yeah. Go for it. We'd love to be a part of that. In general, we just love to hear from everybody out there, about beans, the magical fruit, the mystical fruit, the supernatural fruit, but also not a fruit, not technically. In the meantime, if you would like to hear other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you know where to find them. You can find them in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed, and you'll find that wherever you get your podcast these days. I don't know. There's so many places to get podcasts. But we should be wherever that is that you're going, and if you can rate and review the show at that place, if they let you do that, well, then do that. That helps us out. That's supposedly good, or so they tell me.
Give us five of five beans.
Five out of five beans, but only the good beans, not the witchcraft beans, just the demon defeating beans. So I don't know, sort them out, figure out which one's which.
Five out of five haunted bleeding beans for sexual potency. Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hi, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities, or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.